Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm in the Twickenham garden of a leading international tree expert, Tony Kirkham, MBE. Tony was named as one of the most influential Londoners by the Evening Standard in 2016, which shows just how high Londoners rate trees and Tony Kirkham. Tony has won numerous awards and is on many professional committees. Following his Kew training, he worked at Kew for 40 years and was the head of the Arboretum for many. The Arboretum, Tony likens to a living reference library of trees. At Kew, there are over 14,000 trees, 2,500 different species. Tony, you know them all?
I know most of them, Bunny, quite intimately, actually. Yeah, and I've planted quite a lot, and I've collected quite a lot of them on my travels to replenish the Arboretum after the storm in 1987.
So how many trees could you recognise overall? If I did a tree ident for you, what do you reckon you'd know?
I think I'd probably know, say, 50, 60. What, the tree or the species?
The species.
The species, probably know probably about half of them. Yeah, I mean...
Half of them. So half of 14,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because there are so many subspecies as well, with a lot of similarities, and even purists would struggle to identify them unless they key them out. But I think at first glance, I could probably get quite a lot of them down to a species.
And just so anyone who hasn't clocked it, we are in the flight path here. So we do have a few planes going over. Yeah. And just for anyone who doesn't quite understand species and genus. So if you've got Malus domestica, garden apple tree, which we're sitting under here, I think.
Yeah, this is a Bramley, 100 years old.
Ah, so Malus is the genus and domestica is the species. So
that's,
it's the type
that's
of
correct,
apples, just
yes,
for everyone.
Yeah.
So, Tony, I'm fascinated to be in your garden to see what trees you have. So I can see your neighbours put in a monkey puzzle.
Yeah, that's been in quite a few years, actually. And a few years ago, they took the top out to stop it growing, which it did for about 3 years. But I can see that apical dominance has started again, so it's away again. But, you know, it will stay. We could keep it as a bonsai.
You could keep, yeah. Because that tree is probably 4 meters from the house, 3 or 4 meters, and that will go up to how many hundred feet?
Oh, well, I've seen them at 30 meters in the wild in Chile.
So 100 foot almost.
100 foot. Wow. They make a big tree.
Yeah.
And it would be, yeah, if we allowed it to just carry on, it would be far too big.
But knowing you're next door, do they say to you, Tone, what should we do?
Yeah, all the neighbours, I'm the tree consultant of Witten here, Waverley Avenue.
I bet, yeah. That's so useful for them.
It is.
And your infectiousness presumably has sort of transmitted, and you've probably got more treed gardens here than any other avenue in the country.
I hope so, because some people say, I need to take the tree down, it's creating too much shade. But then I just recommend, well, with some judicious pruning, canopy lifting, thinning, we can keep that tree and maintain, a green oasis.
Mm.
And I've crammed as many trees in here as possible. It's not a large garden. It's an average semi-detached. I was lucky, actually, because it's wider and longer than most gardens because it was the show house when these houses were built. So I got an extra few yards either side of the garden. But...
It's probably 12 metres wide, 15 metres wide?
Yeah, I think it's about 15 metres wide, Bunny. And
30 metres long?
30 metres long,
so 100 foot odd long, yeah. Yes. And you've got, is it chickens at the end?
No, that's just to keep the dogs out. That's my little nursery where I grow trees and, potch about.
Lovely. And so in your garden, you were showing me that very rare tree on the corner. Just describe that.
Yeah, this is a rare tree from China. It's a Chinese pearl bloom, Polyathersis sinensis. And it's monotypic, so it's the only one in that genus. And you've caught it. I was hoping and praying that it would be looking like it is today for you, Bonnie, because it is a really special tree. This is, I've grown this from seed collected off an original Wilson collection, one that Ernest Wilson introduced in 1901. And this is seed from that. And it's Wilson 500. And in his field notes that I read
Wilson
in...
Wilson 500, meaning that's the...
That's the 500th collection that Wilson made in China.
Oh, right.
And I was reading his field notes, and he said that when it comes into... Because most of them are like a cream flower, so... Okay, but this is exceptional because it flowers yellow, and he describes that in his field notes, and it actually comes true from seed with this yellow bloom, which is beautiful.
Oh, interesting. Now, while you're talking about true from bloom, so I was working on a garden about 2 years ago, and they had the most buried holly I'd ever seen. It was a beautiful evergreen holly, and it was absolutely covered with berries. I've never seen one so heavily buried, so I took some berries home. And 2 years later, they took 2 years to germinate, but I've now got lots of little holly trees. So what is the chance, do you think, well, that they will be true to type? They will be cross-pollinated by a male, obviously, and that male probably won't be the same.
That's right. And they... It could be male, could be female.
So it's 50-50 chance, probably, would you say?
And I think you're going to have to plant
a few.
I've got
quite a few seedlings. Yes, well, I'll plant them all.
That'll be good. But whether it'll come, whether it will be as good as the parent, I'm not sure. And to guarantee that, you'd need to grow it from cuttings.
Yeah, exactly. But and I have done many hollies from cutting because they are quite easy. They take a bit of time, but they root pretty easily. And I've got Camellia folia, all the Ferox ones. They're a wonderful genus. I love hollies.
Well, one that's quite popular at present and a real winner is the chestnut leaved.
Yes, Castanifolia. I've got that. I took that from a cutting about 25 years ago, it's fabulous.
It's quite architectural, a strong grower, and I think potentially one. For the future, you know, hollies are struggling a bit in this climate.
I think
that one will be a good one.
So they get verticillium wilt, don't they? Is that their main problem?
I think so, yeah.
So why are they struggling? Because I always think of them as sort of great in shady places. Why are they struggling?
Well, I think people are planting in autumn situations where they're drying out, and their roots are it's probably the roots that are struggling. Yeah. And on a day like today, you know, it's quite sunny, it's hot, and that a lot of them are unable to take that those high UV levels. You know,
right.
And we talk a lot now about drought tolerant plants, but we need to be looking at UV tolerant. Plants as well.
That's a really good point. So is your wife, does she also share your passion? Because this looks to me like your garden. Am I right or am I wrong?
You're right, Bonnie. Yeah.
How did I guess?
It is my garden. And I've just started gardening, really, because, you know, when I was in full-time occupation at Kew, the last thing I wanted to do was to come home and garden. But since I've been retired, so I retired 3 years ago this week.
I don't think you've really retired, but I'll let you get away with it for now.
But I'm enjoying, you know, gardening. And I was gardening this weekend, and Sally said, "Is the you know, the horticultural queen coming this weekend?" So well, I want it to be looking good. So it's been mulched and weeded and. Yeah,
I see all the lovely mulch.
But so you're right, Bunny, it is my garden.
Yeah. So when you bang on about trees and you come home having seen the biggest tree in wherever, does she go, oh, yawn, yawn, or does she share any passion?
No, she shares that passion, and she enjoys seeing them too, actually. So she joins me now
on
a lot of my travels, looking at trees, some of my lecture tours, etc. And even at the weekend, we were at Blenheim Palace and we were looking at old ancient oaks. And she's a model to show for scale and size.
Oh, I see. And what was her career? Did she...
She's a botanist. So she has a degree in botany at Manchester.
That's
so
helpful.
She's more qualified than I am.
Yeah.
Her working career, she was at St Paul's Boys' School as a careers and universities officer.
I see. Yeah. So that must be really nice for you to have when you're going off on your trips abroad collecting seed or talks, you've got some mate to go with.
Exactly.
Which makes it far more enjoyable.
A really good travelling companion.
Yeah.
And all our family holidays have all been focused on my bucket list of trees that I want to see growing in the wild. So, and then one year she said, I'm going to take you to and we're going to go this year, we're going to go on holiday where there are no trees. So I said, fine.
Desert
that,
island.
A surprise. She took me to the Sahara Desert. And actually, there's some nice trees in the Sahara Desert, very special. So that was a great, great holiday.
Yeah. And what about your children?
My children, I've got two. Jennifer is 34, I think. She's a building surveyor. She likes trees, but probably not as much as myself. And and my son's an IT manager for a company in London. So, but he did an apprenticeship in horticulture. So he's a qualified horticulturalist. He just decided to change career at the end of that for more money, really.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I remember with my children, when they were very young, I did a book and it included treehouses, a whole chapter on treehouses, and it would be, oh, not another treehouse, please.
I know the exact feeling, because one year I took them to see the biggest, the tallest, and the oldest tree in the world in California. And after we did the biggest, which was great, Jennifer enjoyed that, did the tallest, yeah, okay. And then by the time we got to the oldest, she'd lost the will to live. And it cost me 2 days retail therapy in Macy's.
Oh, expensive.
In San Francisco.
Expensive, that.
Yeah.
So, and at what point did you realise that you had a real affinity with trees? When did it catch you?
I think probably when I was about 10 years old. So I knew when I was 10 that I was going to work with trees.
And what you remember that moment, and what was it?
I was in the scout movement. So I grew up in a rural town in Lancashire called Darwen. So I was on the edge of the moors. And my play, I was lucky because we had three municipal parks for the cotton workers. So that was my playground, and there were some fantastic trees, and you know, lots to see and do, and but it was a horse chestnut tree actually that caught my attention, and I planted. I can't plant a horse chestnut in here; it would be too big. So I planted Rudgersia, esculifolia here, as a reminder. But
this is a sort of low.
This is
a
low
perennial, which grows to about 300, 400 high.
You're amazed at that, aren't you, Bonnie? That I'm planting perennials.
Yeah. I can also see an agapanthus.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And loads of epimediums.
Yeah, I've got into epimediums.
Yeah. Good shade, but loving tree plants. Yes.
We digress.
Yes.
And this horse chestnut. Every Friday, I was the blackboard monitor, and I had to collect the blackboard dusters and then run down to the end of the playground and beat them on this horse chestnut trunk to get the chalk off so they were ready for use on Monday. And I was just fascinated by this horse chestnut. And, of course, it was my source of ammunition for Conkers. So that was the main game, you know, no computers, so it was Conkers. And the teacher realised that I was interested in trees and told us more about, you know, why it was called the horse chestnut, where it came from. And I was just fascinated by that, and then decided then that I was going to work with trees.
And did you know, at what point did you realise there was such a thing as an arborist or an arboriculturalist?
Well, I left school and went into forestry. So I started an apprenticeship in forestry at 16. And it was probably about 3 years, when I was about 19, that I learnt about arboriculture and that was such a thing as an arborist. And I switched from forestry into arboriculture. I went to Marist Wood College and then worked in Germany as a tree surgeons then, but as an arborist. And then decided I wanted to know more about horticulture. And that's when I applied to Kew, and Kew gave me a wild card because I didn't have the qualifications. So, and I went to Kew and realised that actually trees are the bee's knees and above everything else, and that's what I'd stay with.
So you were very lucky at identifying what your passion was at such a young age. That makes such a difference.
Extremely lucky that I had a career path marked out. And yeah, very, very fortunate, and supported by, you know, my parents, and then when I, you know, married Sally, she's given me a lot of support as well.
And it's not many people that say they could start their career, say, at 20, and then they usually retire, you know, at 55, 60, and they're fed up to the teeth of dentistry, accountancy, medicine, whatever. But with yours, you've been able to sort of pursue it in several different formats, in a way, adding on to each bit.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. And I've been very lucky. And I don't think I'll ever retire. You know, I love lecturing. I love speaking. I do a lot of writing now. You know, lots of books. I've got a couple on the go now. And I love it, and I love travel, and I love and I love trees, and you know, it's a hobby now.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm interested to hear that on the Archers. Are you an Archers fan of Radio 4?
Well, I'm not, but they've got an arborist, and they've got a little business going, haven't they?
That's
and I've
right.
Been I've been listening to that, and I was listening to the jangling of. She said, because she's the arborist, and she's
Emma,
me a carabiner, she said the other day, and I thought, blimey, they were right on it here.
Yeah, so the Archers, for those who aren't listeners, is a Radio 4 thing that's been going forever, and it was initially set up to be an information programme about farming, wasn't it? And now there's not a lot of farming in it, more sort of homosexuals, lesbians, and current problems, but it's nice that they brought in arboriculturalists, so I think they're going to go deep, and we're going to find out all sorts of things about trees and things.
I really hope so. I think it's a really good opportunity for us, and a way of raising awareness of our industry and the careers that people can do in that.
I'd hope that you were actually advisor to them.
Well, I'm not yet, but I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the phone call.
Yeah, I think we should send them an email. Yeah, get them really on stream. So a lot of your work now is going on plant hunting expeditions, and you've been to Chile, Far East Asia, China, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, and more. So what exactly are you looking for?
Well, if I go back, my plant hunting career started in 1985. My first trip was to Chile, and that was to collect seeds to grow trees and plants in the Arboretum at Kew. And then
Kew were always looking for other plants.
Kew were always looking to add to the collections, and it wasn't until 1987 we had the Great Storm. Most people remember what they were doing on the 16th of October that night when we had those winds that we lost about 15 million trees across the south of England. At Kew we lost about 700, and then we needed to fill the gaps and replenish the collections. So we did an audit, looked at where our weaknesses were geographically and taxonomically, and that set out a program for plant exploration.
I see.
And the Far East was where the weakness was. And can you believe it? We didn't have one tree growing in the Arboretum from Chile. From Taiwan, apart from we didn't have anything. There was a few things growing in the temperate house, but nothing outside.
And would parts of Taiwan have a similar climate?
Yeah, well, everyone said, well, I don't know why you're going to Taiwan. It's tropical, but it's only tropical at sea level, and then the higher you go, the more temperate it becomes. So if you go above 2,000 meters, you're into temperate woodland. And most of the trees above 2,000 metres will grow in this country. And there's some fantastic trees. It's a beautiful place. And not just trees, but shrubs as well.
Well, and so it's whole genuses that we have.
Oh, yeah. The Taiwania.
Yeah.
Named after the island, a conifer, almost the size of the coastal redwoods. You know, that's growing outdoors in the Pinetum at Kew now from those expeditions, from that expedition in 1982. 1992.
I remember you said telling me years back that, you know, any tree you plant today, Bunny, you know, it's got to survive the climate in 50 years time.
Yes.
Plus.
Yeah.
And then we will be, you reckoned we'd be, well, you said that a few years ago, but sort of almost middle of France.
Yes.
We're maybe going further south.
Further
now.
South now.
You think 50 years hence will be like the Mediterranean, France.
Well, 2050, the predicted temperatures are now those of Barcelona. So that you can, it's going to be hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that means what ones are really going to be hit in the neck then? Do you think that really will not like that?
Well, I think a lot of the pioneer species that we're planting now, things like birches, rowans, mallus, all these small short-lived trees, I think they're going to find it really tough. And not then, but already now, they're showing signs of stress, you know, with that heat like today where, you know, we might make 30 degrees today and it could be the hottest day. That, you know, those trees do not like that heat. And even when you get the water on them, the leaves just crisp.
They are all shallow rooted, am I right in thinking? Birches, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, all trees are shallow rooting.
But very shallow rooted.
They're shallow root. Yeah, yes. They're very shallow rooting, and they don't invest in
tap root. In
rooting and wood. So they're relatively short lived. They can live for a long time, but usually they're short lived. And it's the big shade trees that we're going to need. So the big hardwoods, the big conifers that we're going to need in a few years' time to give us that canopy cover. That's what we're going to need.
But if you've got a little garden, there's no way you're going to plant something massive. So if you're counting out mallus, rowan and birch, what would you... I see you've got a beautiful hazel tree there. So, and you've got a multi-stem hazel that you've pruned. So is it multi-stem? Well, it is sort of. It branches about a foot off the ground in a nice contorted fashion.
It's actually grafted onto Turkish hazel.
So
it doesn't sucker.
Yes.
And it was close to the ground, hence that's a bed that I've got to deal with and I couldn't see this beautiful garden that I'd done. So, and I was at Chelsea and saw all these multi-stem cleaned up and thought, actually, I'm gonna clean my hazel up. And so that's what I've done. I've just lifted it and thinned it.
Yeah, so
and
when you say cleaned up, you mean you removed all
I've
the lower
removed all
level
the lower
foliage.
Branches. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm stopping
I
them coming back.
Appreciated that. So you're talking about Tom Stuart Smith's garden.
Yeah.
And he had multi-stem hazel that were huge
and they
scale.
Were on a short stem.
And they're on a short leg and they were cleaned up.
That's right.
And that's why they look so amazing, didn't they? Because you could see the trunk. But that to actually maintain them like that, you'd be cutting the side shoots off.
Yeah.
Six times a summer, wouldn't you? Because they grow back ferociously. But Turkish hazel doesn't do that, does it?
No, the Turkish hazel and any they don't. It doesn't sucker. So there's some shoots at the bottom. They're the contorted hazel.
Yeah.
But I actually de-shooted it about 2 weeks ago, and you can already see shoots coming back. So you've got to keep rubbing them off.
You're going to keep rubbing.
You know, it takes a couple of minutes.
Because I always thought Turkish hazel didn't. Yeah, it doesn't have any shoots from lower ground.
No, so that hence it's a Turkish hazel, clean stem at the bottom.
Bottom, yeah.
And then it stays pure contorted hazel.
Yeah, because often with squirrels and hazelnuts, you know, they say that's a good thing to grow them on a Turkish hazel stock.
Yeah.
And then you can put a baffle around the tree to stop the squirrels getting up. But it's quite... Did you graft that yourself?
Well, a friend of mine grafted it, Ian Fitzroy, who is a fantastic grafter. He and the ginkgos that I have, they're all grafted by him as well. And sadly, he passed away quite a while ago. But he used to do trees for me at Kew. So if I saw a really special tree that I wanted a lot of, he would graft them for me.
He was
a good grafter.
I see. Interesting. Mm. So Turkish hazel might be a nice tree for a small garden.
Turkish hazel is going to be a good tree. You know, as an urban tree, it's tough. And I've actually been to Turkey to see them growing in the wild, and actually there's not much else that grows there. So if a tree can grow there, they're going to be very useful.
I've actually at home, I've formed some hazels into archways.
Oh, yeah.
But it is I take off the basal foliage that keeps growing back all the time. And it is a bit of a job, but they do form lovely archways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're such a beautiful tree.
I think hazel's a really versatile tree.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of the red forms now, there's a red, the new leaves that come out on one of the Turkish hazels. I forgot the name of it now, but it's in the trade, and that's beautiful.
Another tree that I love for small gardens is the persimmon tree.
Yeah.
Now in Stamford, just near Burley Park in Lincolnshire, they've got a lovely persimmon that is absolutely covered in orange fruit all over the Christmas period.
Is it the khaki, the big one?
I think it's khaki, yes. Yeah. Is it khaki or khaki? Khaki? Diasporus.
Khaki.
Diasporus khaki. And so an Iranian friend, both of ours, that we help, he planted a whole load, which he bought before I came in.
Yeah.
And only one survived. And last time I visited, I noticed he'd removed it. But he is very exposed. So I've planted one at home against the south wall, or near the south wall.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's growing very slowly. But would you think that would be hardy in the southern parts of the UK? Because it's just such a beautiful tree.
Definitely. And that tree that you mentioned, I pruned last week just to get some light into it. It's done incredibly well.
In the walled garden.
In the walled garden, near the greenhouse, yeah.
Yes.
And it's done too well, actually. So I've thinned it, and there's no fruit. It didn't flower this year. There's no fruit on it.
Because it's so cold, perhaps, do you think?
It fruited really well the year before, and I think it's just having a rest.
Right, yeah.
But I pruned it, and I lifted the crown because nobody could get past it. But it is a good tree. There are three species, actually, that we grow over here. Lotus is one, which has a small fruit, and that is from Western Asia, Eastern Mediterranean, Western Asia. So a good, a really good tree for the future climate. And then the North American one, Virginiana, which has that alligator bark. It looks like an alligator stood up, deep fissured bark.
Yeah.
Slightly bigger fruit. And again, really tough. And they've all got shiny leaves, so they can reflect the light and cope with high UV levels.
Yeah.
And I would recommend any of those for a small garden.
Better than khaki?
No, I think khaki's probably, if you want persimmons or the sharon fruit, then khaki's one to grow. But it will have rest years. They do have that rest year.
But mine is just so slow, and I think it's because the bed that it's in is very compacted soil. But I bang on the mulch to help that.
I was going to say, good mulch.
Yeah.
And get round it with a fork, just aerate that soil, and I think they can be a bit moody in the early years. So they sit there and seem to take quite a long time to establish. But once they get the feet down and they're happy.
I've noticed you've referred to trees as moody before, and I've also noticed you refer to trees as she.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, do you think they're more, do you always think of them, or is it just certain trees that you think of as she?
I think all the nice ones I call she, all the difficult ones I call he.
Oh, right.
I think all trees, I compare trees to people because they are just like us.
Mm.
And they're moody, they're stressy, but they're beautiful when they're happy. And our job growing trees is to keep them as stressed, de-stressed, as stress-free as possible. And again, something that we hear in a lot of at present is planting the right tree in the right place.
Yeah.
But I add another extra thing, another R for the right reason.
Yeah.
So, why, before we plant a tree, what do we want in that space? Are we looking for a big shade tree? Are we looking for screening? Are we looking for flowers or all those ornamental attributes? Are we looking just to soak carbon up and feel good? Are we looking for a tree that makes us feel good? Or are we planting one for biodiversity?
I think that with anything, with any border or hedge or fence, you want to see what is its function.
Exactly.
What do I want it to do?
Yeah.
And a lot of design, I think, is down to that, isn't
it?
It's logistics of what's going to work, really.
Yeah.
So that's interesting when you say about planting trees, because one thing that I think frustrates you as well as me is when I started off in horticulture in the early 70s, I remember reading Alan Mitchell. He's long gone now, presumably.
He passed away quite a while ago.
He was an arboriculturalist, wasn't he, that did a lot of work with research on trees.
That's right. Yeah.
And he wrote numerous articles in things like, you know, we shouldn't be planting big trees, we shouldn't be staking them. Water's important in the early years, not fertilizer. Yep. And despite that, written almost 50 years ago and being spread slowly, yeah, you go everywhere, all yeah over the world and here, and you see people planting huge great things with massive great stakes
yeah
that look like feathers on the end of big poles and yeah pretty hideous and often die. Why haven't we got the message across? Why is it in horticulture generally we seem to do what we've always done and think it's the best, and we never look up scientific research and do yeah find out?
Do you know what, Bunny? There's something called observation, and yes, we don't use enough of it. So we're constantly relying or looking for scientific evidence. But you know, sometimes you just need to stop and have a look around and think about what you're doing, and observe how trees grow, and so what do you need to plant? I mean, I don't mind planting big trees if they're grown by a good reputable nursery.
And if you can look after them,
exactly,
and if you accept the fact they're not going to romp on from that stage, they will probably yeah sit at that size.
Yeah.
For 5-10 years before moving on?
I mean, I'm a lover of AirPods.
Yeah, I too.
AirPods, I love AirPods. You can see I've got quite a few here.
Can you just describe why AirPods yeah are better than a conventional pot?
So one of the things that we've never liked doing is growing trees in round, rigid pots. So we get spiraling roots. And what we want to do is encourage a really good fibrous root system. We're well branched and encourage tree roots to go down. So the air pot, it's like a sheet of egg box. And on the end of each protrusion, there's a hole. And tree roots need air, oxygen, just as much as the top of the tree does. So the air pot encourages, it air prunes. So as the root reaches that air, it stops and then produces lots of lateral roots off that main root back to the trunk.
And these are something that nurseries use to grow them on in, don't they? So when you move them,
yeah,
you unscrew the air yep pot, pop and it in the hole.
The tree doesn't even know it's moved. You yeah know, it's and so a lot of the good nurseries are using. I'm not saying that all, you know, all the nurseries are using them. There are other good nurseries that use alternative systems, but some of the big tree nurseries are using air pots. And you know, when that tree, it's got a flat bottom, so when it goes in, when you plant it and put it in the hole, it's not rocking and rolling like a tree with a round root ball that we've been used to. And and so it requires less staking,
or no staking at all.
And they're very, very quick to grow out of that root ball and establish. And we need to get rid of the term tree planting, Bunny.
So what would you call it instead?
Tree establishment.
Tree establishment.
Yeah. So we need to be establishing trees, not planting trees.
Yeah.
And a lot of the targets, ridiculous targets that are being set, it's number crunching.
Mm.
And how many of those trees that are planted will be alive in 3-5 years' yeah time? And yeah a lot of trees that we're planting today, we're actually contributing to the carbon problem, because if we plant a tree and it doesn't survive and dies, then it is releasing all that carbon back into the atmosphere.
And all the travel that it's taken to get there
exactly
and the planting. Yeah,
we've
that's
got
a very
to be
good
establishing
point
trees, not planting yeah trees.
I always remember years ago, I was working for someone who bought out one of these big tree nurseries. And so his garden, he said, oh, Bunny, I can get all these free. Let's just put in all these big trees. And so I said, okay, but let's also then plant a load of tiny transplants and feathers over there.
Yep. Good idea.
And just compare them. And yeah after about 5 years, he came yeah and he said, Bunny, you're dead right.
Yeah.
All yeah the ones I put, yours have overtaken mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what and also, as Alan Mitchell pointed out all those years ago, is you get a much more natural shaped trees. The yeah branches aren't so close together.
Yeah.
And they're more spaced and they're happier, natural.
Yeah.
And you, at the look of the wooden stakes and the actual where yeah the tie is on the trunk for the stake,
yeah
the trunk is often thicker above the tie yeah than below, which yeah is totally rubbish.
And I'm like you, I'm very anti-staking, and we stake for the sake of staking. And most trees that we plant don't need stakes. You know, if certainly in a garden like this, even if you planted a big tree, it might need a cane for a year, but it, you know, I do very little tree staking. No,
I was going to say, because I'm on top of a hill, okay, we planted shelter belts and things, but I've planted extra heavy standards with no stakes.
Yes.
I did it with some photo shoot or something. I wouldn't normally do that. Cause
I'm
going to
say, so you do plant big trees,
only for a photo shoot. Normally, they all went in. My huge evergreen oaks that are now huge drums went in as little 30-centimetre jobs.
Yeah.
And, of course, the best is seed, isn't it? But that is quite a process. But trees grown naturally from
seed.
Well,
the polyathersis there, which is, what, four or five metres tall, that went in as almost a feathered tree about a metre tall, and it's only been in 4 years,
grown
from seed.
But it has had TLC, Tony. You watered it well when you popped it in.
I do, and it hasn't. I haven't watered it this year at all, and I didn't water it last year at all. So it's already established and away. But those first 2 years, I made sure it had water. I've got gator bags, tree gators, which I love.
Yes. Yeah. And so I think explain to someone who doesn't know what they are.
Yeah, so the gator bag is a bag that was designed in America during a drought period. And it's a bag that zips around the base of a tree. And you can then fill the bag. It takes 20 gallons of water. And it's got very fine stitching around the base. And water slowly percolates out over a 10-hour period. And the water goes where you want it, rather than standing there with a hose pipe. The term we should use is, because there are other makes than gator bags, is hydration bags.
Hydration bags.
And they've, for the cost, they're... And providing,
so what is the cost of one of those?
I think the cost of a gator bag is about £25-30. But if you're buying a tree that's a few hundred pounds, it's nothing in the grand scheme of things. And you're absolutely right. What you said earlier is forget the fertilizer in the first couple of years. They don't need it. They just need water. So don't put the fertilizer on. And what you save from that, buy a gator bag.
But then if, of course, if you plant a transplant or feathered and you plant them in late summer, early autumn, you probably won't need to water at all, ever.
You get it. If providing they're planted correctly and mulched, then you'll get away with it.
I've got lots of tree queries, Tony, but firstly, you is probably one of my favourite trees. It's very versatile. It's the oldest tree, perhaps 2,000-3,000 years old.
Yeah.
Often there before churches and churchyards, showing they are the site of an older sacred site.
Yeah.
They're highly toxic, the seed, not the fleshy part. But in the New Forest, whenever I go and work down there, you see loads of yew trees, and then you have all the wild cattle and sheep and horses. Why don't they eat them and die?
I think they're smarter than we are. And maybe one chew, and then they realise that it's not good.
Well, you say that, but I know a stately home where the cattle got into the wood with a load of yew trees in it. And they walked out and bang, 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 they all dropped dead.
Did they?
So they do. Maybe when they're brought up in the New Forest, they really...
Yeah,
very odd, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I certainly wouldn't be planting yew trees around a field where there are horses or cattle.
No. It's lethal, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it just always fascinated me when you drive around the New Forest and you see all these yew trees.
Well, one of the things that I do, I travel around Britain going to churches, looking at yew trees. There's some fantastic specimens, you know, old specimens that, predate the church.
What's the oldest you think you've seen?
Well, the oldest I've seen the Dyffiniog yew in Wales, which is thought to be about 4,000 years old, and then the they've all hollowed out. So and you wonder, well, how do they know how old it is? But they go off church records, photograph, you know, old paintings,
Google maps.
Things like that, and they can usually get a date on them. But they are fascinating things, and if I go and see one, I'll sit under it, touch it, talk to it, and just wonder what that tree has seen and heard.
Yeah.
Quite amazing, really.
It is phenomenal. At the moment, you know, it's all about getting into nature, forest bathing, amino terpenes making us feel good.
Yeah.
And all this sort of thing, which is everyone's raving about. But I think most people who work with plants instinctively know there's something therapeutic, yeah. don't you? I mean, all yeah. research is lovely. It's come yeah. to back up our thoughts.
Exactly.
But you do feel so amazing.
Yeah.
And then Peter Wallenbein, I don't know if you're a fan of his, but he hit the headlines when he collated lots of research about how
yeah.
trees talk to each other.
Yeah.
And so if there's some caterpillars, they will sort of send out odours
yeah.
that will attract birds to come and eat the caterpillars.
Yeah.
And all this sort of thing, and they can detect the difference between the saliva of deer and caterpillars. But with all these weird facts, what are the ones that most surprises you?
Well, I really enjoyed reading that book when it came out, and I think it generated lots of PhDs of, you know, the scientists didn't like it because it was all based on observation, which I'm a lover of.
Yes.
But actually, the scientist, it created lots of PhDs, I think probably more to try and prove him wrong rather than right.
But I assumed he wrote the book by going through all the papers on Google Scholar or something.
No, no.
I thought he did that.
No, it's all based on his observation as a forester in Germany.
Oh,
and I,
God.
And, you know, a yes. lot of it is, you know, he talks about the naughty trees and the well-behaved trees. And the naughty trees being the pioneer species who let their young go off and do their own thing and get asbos and things. Whereas the well-behaved trees like the beech and the oak, that the acorn or the beech mast drops under the tree and the tree looks after it until it's ready to go. And I just love all that. And there's got to be something to it. And, you know, we describe trees like people and how, you know, how they get stressed and I you know, that it all comes out in that book and how trees communicate. And I remember talking to a student at Oxford when I was doing a film with Judi Dench. I just had to get that one.
Oh,
in.
Yes. Cracker, that one.
Yeah. And I kept saying to her, you know, when trees talk to each other, and she said, no, you can't say that. They don't talk. They communicate. And it was a bit of a grounding for me, you know, slap wrist.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
communicate. And I think it's fascinating how they do. And that's why I think we need to plant trees together so that they can, you know, there's a lot goes on underground that we just don't know about.
Mm.
But as you say, sending out pheromones to each other to say, put more tannins into your leaves because there's an army of caterpillars eating me, and if you don't do that, they're going to come and eat you soon, you know.
Yeah.
And trees respond to that.
And then when they have a very dry summer,
yeah,
then the next year they perhaps come into leaf a bit later. They
yeah.
don't use so much
yeah.
water, don't grow
yeah.
so much.
Exactly.
Because they're waiting for it.
Yeah.
But when you say it's generated a lot of PhD, so people will then take up a fact like that and prove
yeah.
it and write a paper on it,
yeah.
yes. And have any of those come out to conclusive results?
I think there's a lot come out scientifically since he wrote that book.
Right.
Now, whether
yeah.
it's just coincidence or whether he's generated that, I don't know. But I think it's all good. You know, it's all good stuff.
Oh, yes. The more we know about
yeah.
them, the better. Because
yeah.
I remember when I first started working and planting trees, schemes and things like that, I think a lot of people are scared of trees. You know, they'd say, oh, but what happens if the branch falls on the house? This is when you,
yes.
you'd work for an estate builder and he built lots of houses
yeah.
and you'd retain the big trees.
Yeah.
And then you'd work really hard to train them. You'd
yeah.
arrange the building so they weren't affected by the trees.
Yeah.
And then the owners would move in and immediately try and get them removed.
Yeah.
Either because they were scared of them or because they thought they had honey fungus that was
yeah.
going to invade the rest of their garden. Or they thought their house foundations were going to pile, or that they pulled in birds that were going to poo all over their
yeah.
car, or that there were always these things, leaves. They'd have to rake up leaves
yeah.
in autumn.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, they were like the bogeyman.
Yeah.
But I think people are beginning to like them more. We realise,
yeah.
I mean, you see some huge great magnolia trees in trunks
yeah.
a foot diameter right next to an old 14th
yeah.
century medieval
yeah.
hall, and it's not shifted, but
yeah.
maybe it didn't have foundations. And and we now think honey fungus isn't what it was,
yeah.
And actually it's in the air all around us,
yeah.
and it's only going to attack the odd wheat tree perhaps.
Yeah.
So how do you address all these fears that people have when they say, Tony, please come and cut this thing down?
Yeah. Well, I try and educate them, Bunny, and I don't want to be too dictatorial, if you like, but I talk to them about how trees function, what they need, why we need them, and the benefit, and then explain the benefits of trees, how they improve all our eco services, all our eco system services, you know, like cleaner air, that they're absorbing carbon, that we need them. And here we are, we, you know, sat under this amazing Bramley apple, 100 years old, that, and this is probably reducing the temperature here where we're sat by about 7-8 degrees. You know, if we go out and sit in the middle of that lawn, we'd be under a bit of pressure from those UV rays. So I try and explain this to them and then say, well, you know, you could do this to the tree, you could prune it this way, and you would still benefit from, you know, the, you'd still get more light, it's not going to fall on the house, it's got a good root system, there's no decay in it. If we've got honey fungus, then we can live with that. You know, the trees, they can get used to that, and we keep them stress free, so they'll live with honey fungus. I think every garden's probably got some form of honey fungus in there.
And do you subscribe to the willow mulch? They say willow, which has salicylic acid in it.
Yeah, I do.
Can help combat.
So you're right. Willow mulch has salicylic acid. And what it does, it triggers the defense systems and immune systems of trees, just like it does with us. So everyone thinks that willow, you know, an aspirin cures a headache. No, it doesn't. All it does is trigger the properties in our body to fight the headache and get rid of them. And it's the same in trees. I love, if I'm pruning this tree, I chop all the clippings up and put them into my compost, because they're full of sugar. All fruit trees have lots of sugar. And if we can get that sugar into the compost and then use it as a mulch, the tree takes it in, it's like a Red Bull to the tree, or a Lucozade, you know, it just gives it that lift when it needs it. So lots of good things out there.
Yeah. And also, you say it cools the environment, but I planted shelter belts because we were so exposed.
Yeah.
And it also reduces heating bills and winter, because it lifts and filters the winds and it keeps it warmer. Yeah. And it makes... The wind chill factor is so reduced in the winter, and it cools the place in the summer. It's totally changed my microclimate. Yeah. What was an unbearably exposed, hot and cold garden is now so much more livable in. Yeah.
If you go to America, the house owners value trees in the garden. They're an asset, a capital asset. You know, and they plant big shade trees right next to the house.
Yeah.
So in summer when they're in leaf, they reduce their air conditioning bills because of the shade. And then in winter when they drop their leaves, they get solar gain through that canopy that reduces their heating bills. So it's a win-win situation. And they've learned to live with trees and value them as an asset.
Oh, well, I hope people are encouraged to plant more and plant them properly. Can you give me a top gardening tip? Or something to do with tree care, perhaps?
I mean, I love mulch, Bonnie, as you can see.
Yes.
So I've constantly got mulch around plants.
What's the maximum you reckon you put on a year?
I think I put about 4 inches a year on. Of mulch, and that's a mixture of wood chip and horse manure or straw or garden compost, so it's a mixture. And don't be afraid of using pure wood chip, fresh wood chip. You know, we've got a lot of ash being cut down at present for ash dieback, and you know, if you find somewhere where those branches have been chipped, then don't be afraid of using that. Use that on the garden.
So my only query with that is, I remember one client put fresh oak chip on their garden and the tannins came out and it killed off a newly planted border. And no doubt that oak particularly has a lot of tannic acid in it, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't leave it in a pile for 3 months, it could, where it can leach out, it can be quite acidic. So would you put oak fresh on?
Well, it's quite interesting to hear that, but I presume that was all the herbaceous plants that it killed.
It was new hedge she planted.
Oh, new hedge.
So they were 60, 90 root bald yews.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
And it killed them.
Yeah. So, yeah, dry it, compost it.
Yeah.
And then put it out.
Yeah, I normally, just to be on the safe side, now wait 3 months, because I have an arrangement with local tree surgeons who will come with a trailer load.
Fantastic.
And dump it off.
Yeah.
And I just put it on neat. And this business, they used to say, it robbed the plants of nitrogen if you put fresh things. But now they found, as long as you leave it on the top and you don't dig it in, it doesn't do that.
And the tree will take it down as it needs it, as it wants it. They're smart things.
And at Burley Park, where they've had massive compaction from the horse trials and things, they had lots of oak suffering from... they get dieback.
Acute oak decline.
Acute oak decline. Yeah. And they put a load of mulch all under the canopy, 50 mil or so. And it was literally like a Persil soap pad advert. Yeah. You know, the ones they put the mulch under were green a year later, and the ones that weren't were all dying.
I'm glad to hear that, because I was the one who recommended that.
Oh, to Pete Glassy.
To Pete Glassy, yeah.
And he took me along.
Fascinated by what he'd been doing to the limes, and I said, get these mulch, decompact them.
Was you. Yeah. And he took me out with his penetrometer.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a penetrometer, it's a little metal probe, in case you think it's something else. And you push it into the ground, and when you push it into the ground where he'd mulched about 12 months ago, you could just plunge it in so easily.
Yeah.
It was like a knife in a sponge cake.
Yeah.
And then when you put it in one that hadn't been mulched, I couldn't get it in.
Yeah.
And it just aerated.
Massive difference. Absolutely.
Aerated the soil. Just explain how this works.
Well, you put the mulch on. The trees will take it down as they need it, but also it invites invertebrates, insects, worms to come into the mulch. And then they start to aerate and start to decompact as well, because they'll go down and then they'll take it down. And if we get some cold weather, they'll go a little bit deeper. And that's how mulching works. So these beds here, I'm very anti-digging. I didn't dig any of these. This was one big lawn. I put the path system in, and then I just mulched the beds, left them mulched for a few weeks, killed the grass, and then just planted through.
Killed the grass, then you mulched.
And then
I remember reading the University of Bath did experiments on that back
Peter
in
Thode.
The 70s. Peter Thode. Yeah. And ever since then, that's the way I've established all borders.
Yeah.
I use glyphosate to kill the grass, and then I pit plant through the dry, and then
Best
I put
way.
On the mulch.
Best way.
And you're not bringing weed seeds to the surface. Yeah. You're not propagating perennial grasses by digging.
And you're not damaging that soil structure.
That lovely top 6 mil full of stuff. Yes. You're not wrecking. Yeah. No, I quite agree. No, brilliant. Yeah. Thank you for that. One more query before I let you go. Filaria latifolia is another of my favourites. It's often called the green olive or the broccoli tree, because it's got this lovely evergreen sort of broccoli-like canopy. They were really common, weren't they, in Victorian times? And you see big specimens. I'm sure you've got loads at Kew. And at Bath, they've got lots. Then they all died out. And now they're all the rage now. Why? Do you know why they died out?
I don't, but I think... I mean, it was that period where Okuba was planted a lot as well.
Oh, the lovely spotted laurel that we all hate.
We call
now.
It the toilet bush, because it was always planted round toilets in Victorian parks, wasn't
was
it?
Was it?
Yeah. And I've got a little Okuba there. That's my favourite from the Himalayas, Okuba Himalayica, which I planted this year. I saw it at Wisley on Battleston
Which
Hill.
Which one is it? I can't see it.
It's just in front of the fork there. The
tiny.
Small one.
Yes.
Beautiful thing. And when you see that in flower... Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous.
So what's that name again? Okuba?
Okuba Himalayica. It's got a variety as well. I can't remember the variety. But I got that from Burncoos. Beautiful plant with that purple broccoli-like flower. I think Filaria, great plant, underplanted. So what we need to be careful of is that, because it's in the ash family, that it's not going to be affected by ash dieback, because ash dieback is jumping from ash onto other genera in the ash family. So we just need to watch that.
Right.
But a great tree.
Yeah, I love it. I brought a whole load of rooted cuttings, and I've sort of grown them on to do different things like hedges, topiary.
Oh, fantastic topiary
shrubs.
Plant.
Yes,
and
really
I think
good.
Is some of the osmanthus as well.
Yeah.
Osmanthus. Now, what's is it? Delavayi,
Delavayi, Aquifolium, Fragrantissima. They're all
fantastic.
Wonderful. I love them all.
And underused.
Yeah, we use them a lot as multi-stem trees.
Good.
When you've got a smallish garden, or I put them in large baseless pots.
Yeah.
So they jump them up, so they're at eye level.
Yeah.
And they are beautiful. Really nice. Really nice. Well, it's been lovely to see your garden, Tony. I bought you a wee present, as I always do, and this is a tiny rooted cutting, because I haven't had this one for long. But I thought you might like it because it's a very good plant under dry shade. And I thought he's bound to have loads of trees in his garden.
Yeah.
So it's Mellitus mellicephyllum album.
Wow.
Do you know that?
I don't know.
And it's called the Bastard Balm. But it's one I got from Joe Sherman. And right. He's a great plantsman. Yeah. And it's in the mint family. But it's got white or pink flowers in late spring or summer. And it goes to half
Lovely.
A metre high. So I just thought it would be useful. And I just take cuttings, softwood cuttings from it. And yeah. I've been spreading it in my dry, shady places.
Sally and I are lovers of mint tea. So there's a mint there. And
I can see lemon verbena, can't I?
That's lemon verbena, yeah. Yes. We've got lemon balm and we've got Oregon black.
Oh, right.
Which makes fantastic tea.
Mint. Have you got Moroccan mint?
Not Moroccan, no.
Oh, that's quite good, yeah. isn't it, for mint tea?
Yeah.
But I think the secret to great Moroccan tea is they seem to shove like 6 teaspoons of sugar in. But I don't. I've gone off that.
Yeah, it's
now.
Rather sickly, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, it's lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.